This is an ABC podcast. Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Coming up, a new report says statelessness needs to be factored in when we talk about climate change. Also, there's hope for sufferers of scabies, as research in Fiji shows that the high-profile and controversial drug ivermectin could be key, and AFL grows in Vanuatu. First, though, after more than 2 years of COVID-induced border closures, international travel is picking up again, and for many Pacific countries, that means a return to tourism. But the challenge is in finding workers, with many having left the tourism industry during the pandemic, while others have gone overseas for greener pastures. Dubravka Volodar with this report.
Tourists visiting Pacific Island countries can look forward to cocktails and sunset walks along sandy beaches. But in Cook Islands, the recently reopened tourism industry is facing a major problem.
Rarotonga is just a very busy island. We are short-staffed. We have had the issue of Cook Island people as well as our migrant workers having free access to New Zealand. New Zealand being quite short-staffed themselves, especially for migrant transient workers, have taken on Cook Island people or expatriate workers to work. Meatworks has been a popular one.
Liana Scott manages the four-star Moree Beach Hotel and is the president of the Tourism Industry Council. While occupancy is at 60%, staff shortages mean hotels can't offer their full range of services. Ms. Scott says operators are now hiring workers from Asia as well as closer to home.
We need to make up a little bit for lost ground. So we have already got quite a small population and we are seeking workers from Indonesia, Philippines and Fiji. Fiji probably being the biggest.
One of those planning to move to Cook Islands is Fijian Sanjit Pratap Singh. He's set to emigrate within the next fortnight after spotting a newspaper ad for a job.
I always look forward to working for these island-based countries. So when I saw the advertisement here in Fiji that Cook Island Hotel required a finance and administration manager, so same time it just clicked in my mind, you can see the green light. Meeting different kind of people from different cultural background at the same time, learn their way of living and culture.
The CEO of Tourism Fiji, Brent Hill, isn't worried about losing workers to Pacific countries, but he is somewhat worried about Fiji workers ending up in New Zealand and Australia.
There is a little bit of that. It's probably more the Australia and New Zealand ones because of the higher wages, obviously. We certainly need to look after and attract our fair share of workers too. So there are wonderful opportunities in Fiji. We are trying to manage. It's manageable at the moment, but it's something we continue to work on.
Fiji opened its doors to holidaymakers in December last year, and visitor numbers have been strong.
We just came off a really solid April and May's ticking along really well. And certainly looking ahead into our real peak periods of June, July, August, we're looking really solid. So, yeah, certainly looking forward with optimism.
Vanuatu is following suit soon and is planning to open its borders to tourists in July after more than 2 years of border closures. Paul Pio is with the tourism office there.
So we at the VTO are just doing an inventory of what will be available come 1st of July.
But staff shortages are a challenge for the industry, with Ni Vanuatu workers making up the largest pool of seasonal workers in Australia.
A lot of people have left the country in the last 2 years to venture into other opportunities with the seasonal work in both Australia and New Zealand. Our Department of Labour is addressing those different gaps now with different stakeholders within the government and the private sector to see how best we can address.
And it's a problem that the Vanuatu government is keen to fix before borders reopen.
Dubravka Volodar reporting there. A new study in Fiji has found that ivermectin can reduce serious complications from scabies when given to people on a mass scale. The drug attracted controversy during the COVID-19 pandemic. Former US President Donald Trump was urging people to use it to treat the disease, but doctors were advising against it. And while it might not be effective to deal with COVID, for years it has actually worked to treat antiparasitic diseases like scabies. I spoke with Murdoch Children's Research Institute Professor Andrew Steer.
I think what we've learnt about ivermectin over the past couple of years is it's not an effective drug for COVID. But in fact, we've been working with ivermectin for over a decade for scabies, and the experience of ivermectin in other parasitic infections goes back a couple of decades. And in fact, the discoverers of ivermectin won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2015 for the contribution of the drug in reducing the burden of parasitic infections around the world, particularly in Africa and in Latin America. And what we're excited about with this study is that ivermectin, we've shown, can also be highly effective for scabies.
This is one dose ivermectin. What does that mean in terms of getting the medicine out to people across Fiji and its effectiveness in, I guess, being able to jump on the problem if someone has scabies and how to treat it effectively?
Yeah, the approach for this study and the work that we've been doing for a little while is an approach called mass drug administration or community treatment. So the idea there is that we know that the parasitic infection, in this case scabies, is affecting a lot of people in a community at the one time. And in fact, some people may have the scabies mite, but may not quite realise it yet. So the idea is that we treat the whole community at the one time, kill all of the mites that are on people's skin so they can't transmit it to anybody, and therefore, you know, reduce the burden of disease very quickly and stop people transmitting the mite and the parasite to other people. And we showed in our study that was highly effective in the entire population of the northern division of Fiji, which is over 130,000 people.
And I guess, how much of an impact is this research going to have, or this study, perhaps broadening it out to a wider scope? Is this an issue across the rest of the Pacific? What can it lead to in terms of further studies and how to treat scabies?
Yeah, well, first, in terms of, you know, the rest of the Pacific and beyond, we know that scabies occurs right across the Pacific region. So we have shown previously that the mass drug administration approach to scabies can really reduce the number of people with scabies in a community really effectively. Our first studies in Fiji and Solomon Islands showed around about a 95% reduction. So from now about 20 to 30% of people having scabies down to under 2%. And the really exciting thing is that this study showed that not only does this approach reduce the number of people with scabies, it also reduces the number of people with the complications of scabies. So we showed that the number of people going to the clinic for problems related to scabies, such as the skin sores or the more serious infections, reduced by one-fifth or 20%. And the same with people being required to be admitted to hospital because they were sick with the complications of scabies was also reduced by one-fifth or 20%.
Yeah, the outcomes seem extremely positive. I'm wondering, how accessible is this drug for countries in the Pacific to access and then to take out to people who are dealing with scabies? Can it be made in labs that are in the hubs in the Pacific, or is it imported from overseas? How does that work?
So for the other parasitic infections that I mentioned at the start, which the discoverers won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, that's two conditions called lymphatic filariasis and elephantiasis, and another one called river blindness. And so there's a donation program for that around the world. So we're sort of thinking now about how can we get access to the ivermectin drug in a sustainable and ongoing way. In the Pacific, we're working with partners in the Fiji Ministry of Health and the Solomon Islands Ministry of Health, along with the Kirby Institute in New South Wales, where we've established the World Scabies Program. And that is funding supply of the treatment and the program for two rounds of mass drug administration in both countries. over the next couple of years, which is exciting. And so we're thinking about the next steps beyond that. How do we come up with a sustainable approach? The World Health Organization recognized scabies as an official neglected tropical disease in 2017. That's really helped with a lot of the action. And there's a roadmap by the World Health Organization towards elimination of scabies as a public health problem across the world. And that includes a mass drug administration approach where appropriate. For the Pacific, you know, we are very keen for Australian and New Zealand governments to participate in this work. We do see this kind of approach as being highly effective and we think cost effective. You know, we'd really welcome the contributions from Australian and New Zealand governments in this area.
That was Murdoch Children Research Institute's Professor Andrew Steer speaking there. Public outcries against police violence in Fiji are gaining heat after the forceful arrest of a local bus driver. A video posted on social media shows a police officer pulling forcefully on the driver's head and the man saying that he can't breathe. The officer in question has been suspended from duties while an internal investigation is conducted. But as Marion Farr reports, the Fiji Law Society alleges the use of unnecessary force by police is becoming all too frequent.
Captured on video, a police officer is seen yanking the neck of a young bus driver multiple times. The officer stops and the bus driver is heard saying, "I can't breathe." The alleged incident happened on Monday at a bus stop in the town of Labasa on the island of Vanualevu. Fijian MP Lenora Gerengeretabua from the National Federation Party witnessed the incident.
I saw this police officer trying to pull a driver out of his seat by a handcuff, which was by then attached to the driver's left wrist. Passengers who were sitting in the bus were gesturing and shouting, and I saw a student standing by the door recording or videoing the incident on a mobile phone.
The driver, 30-year-old Elvin Manny, was seated in the bus when it's understood the police officer stepped on board and asked for his name. When the situation escalated, Ms. Gerengeretabua asked the officer to stop.
Excuse me, I'm a member of parliament. You cannot do that.
I said to him, look, you can't do that to him. You can't do that to him.
She says what took place was deeply disturbing.
When times are so hard right now in Fiji, we've been through so much violence as a country, way too much. And to have an officer who has sworn to protect the people behaving in such a manner is just not acceptable, not acceptable at all.
Elvin Manny was taken into custody and charged with seriously assaulting a police officer and failing to give his name and address. The officer in question has now been suspended from his duties pending an internal investigation into his conduct. Monday's events have sparked a public outcry in Fiji, with footage of the arrest shared more than 2,000 times on social media. Mr. Manny's sister, Shelen Manny, says the family has been traumatised.
I am shaken. I am very shaken. It is very disturbing to see what my brother has been going through. All my mother is saying that she has lost the trust in the Fiji police force and she cannot ever believe and trust the Fiji police force ever again.
Ms. Manny says she's asked police for a report into her brother's medical condition, but the request was refused. The ABC has contacted Fiji police for comment but received no response. Ms. Manny says she's deeply concerned about her brother's well-being after a brief conversation with him on the phone yesterday morning.
My mother asked him, "How are you?" The only thing with heavy-hearted, he said, "I'm not well."
President of the Fiji Law Society, Wiley Clark, says while Monday's events were shocking, it's not an isolated case.
What we're seeing is this sort of disproportionate force being used to effect arrests is becoming more and more sort of prevalent. Rather than it being the sort of last step, it's become almost sort of the first response.
And Mr. Clark says that's concerning.
Not only does it undermine public trust, but I think it also erodes the rule of law, because rule of law requires the respect for people's, for human rights and people's right to question authority and to raise legitimate questions about why they are being detained.
The Law Society president believes more should be done to address what he alleges to be systemic issues within Fiji's police force.
I think it really then requires, we think, a closer look at the training that these police officers are receiving, and also the leadership within the police force sending a clearer message that they must use their powers in a sort of more sort of restrained way.
Fiji Law Society President Wiley Clark ending that report from Marion Farr. And local media are reporting that police officer Elvin Manny was released on bail after appearing in the Labasa Magistrates Court. Now, when we think of sea level rise and the destruction caused by climate change, we often think about the immediate impact of people losing their homes and being forced to migrate. But a new report says that the loss of citizenship and nationality should also be factored in when we think about climate change. The report from the University of New South Wales and the University of Melbourne says legal steps must be taken by Pacific countries to protect the rights of their people. Reporter Evan Wasuka spoke with Michelle Foster, director of the Peter McCullen Centre on Statelessness at the University of Melbourne.
So statelessness, the idea of statelessness is the person is stateless if no country recognises them as a national. Now, a person may be born into statelessness or they may lose their nationality in the context of not gaining another nationality, and therefore they are left without a nationality. How does it connect to climate change? Well, as you just said, Pacific Island states, as we know, are bearing the brunt of the worst impacts of climate change. And while most Pacific Islanders want to remain in their homes for as long as possible, Pacific governments are increasingly, albeit reluctantly, considering cross-border mobility as one means of protecting their people from the impacts of climate change. So if people must leave their homes, perhaps permanently, we asked, what happens to their legal connection with their home country? Will they retain that nationality, or are they at risk of losing that nationality? And what we found was that under current citizenship laws, and we analysed the citizenship laws of 23 Pacific Island countries and territories, we found that some Pacific Islanders who leave their homes permanently are at risk of losing the citizenship of their home country, or losing the ability to pass this on to their children. And in some cases, not all, but in some cases, they may even become stateless. And what we also found is that some people may be at risk of statelessness and nationality loss even now, even before they lose they leave their country. So, for example, if there are insufficient safeguards in nationality law to ensure that all children have a nationality at birth. Another example would be gender discrimination in nationality law. So there are, I guess what our report is finding is that, or found, is that there are some reforms that are required immediately to ensure that no one is stateless, but then also reforms that are needed to ensure that statelessness or loss of nationality does not ensue if people are required to leave their homes.
Dr. Foster, are there examples of this happening right now in the Pacific where people are becoming stateless or losing their nationality as a result of climate change?
So our report, as I mentioned, we looked at the nationality laws of 23 countries, and we regard this as a first step to sort of analyse, you know, is there a risk? And then the next step would be to undertake research to find out are there examples of this in individual cases. What we do know is that Pacific states are thinking about virtual statehood. So Tuvalu, for example, has set out a plan to digitise all government services and archive Tuvalu's history and culture to create a digital nation that would retain its sovereignty. So if states are starting to think about this, our report argues they must think about all the implications of movement and that citizenship needs to be, you know, very much at the forefront. As we say, it's not just about statelessness, it's also about loss of nationality, because, of course, most immediately, loss of citizenship would mean a loss of voting rights in a country. And indeed, in some countries, citizens who reside overseas will lose their voting rights. And so we can see that there's already going to be a disconnection if people need to move. And certainly if there's ideas of having some kind of government, you know, in exile or externally, there needs to be consideration to what the nationality, you know, what the composition of that nation would be if people have lost their citizenship. That's obviously going to be a problem.
Michelle Foster, director of the Peter McCullen Centre for Statelessness at the University of Melbourne. Ambitious plans by AFL Vanuatu to spread the word about Australian rules football in a country where soccer is king have been stalled by the outbreak of COVID-19 that has spread across the nation. But undeterred, a small band of Aussie rules disciples have soldiered on and spread their message via social media and through online training programs. And as Talia Olatia reports, with the 2023 International Cup in Melbourne put back to 2024, the hope is that by then Vanuatu might have a team ready to take part.
When the FIFA World Cup comes around again at the end of this year, groups of fans allied to every one of the competing nations will march through the streets of Port Vila, waving the flags of the countries they'll be supporting when the biggest team sport show on earth kicks off. The march has become a tradition in Vanuatu, which is a soccer-crazy nation. And it's against that background that program director Nancy Patterson is trying to sell Australian rules football to the community.
Soccer is the famous sport in Vanuatu, and now rugby is coming up. But with the experience working as a development officer, introducing football in different communities, I have seen lots of people are showing interest, especially the kids. My major job is visiting the schools. So I found out that lots of kids are very interested in this camp. We just need to work more and help them to know the basic skills especially.
Jared Landells is a volunteer sponsored by Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs, who describes himself as a communications, media and policy liaison support officer at AFL Vanuatu. He believes the Australian game can make inroads despite soccer's dominance.
The crowds are enormous and the support for the big clubs in Europe and South America is feverish, and that's a great thing. I think, you know, as a niche sport, as some other sports like volleyball, table tennis, judo, rowing, they've all seen that the playing field is probably not level, but there are some really important ways that they can achieve some goals that they've set themselves, whether it be at Olympic level or a regional level or community-based level.
And AFL Vanuatu have had some success at the local level. But Nancy Patterson says their biggest problem is not having the right ground to play on.
We have competitions going on, and there's 6 senior men's team and a 5 women's team. But the challenge we face is a footy overhaul that we should have to get more people coming in and more teams to come in and participate. As now the sports resume again, we're looking forward to get more people. In this year's competition, I'm looking forward to get more young people interested in the game and to get more teams to take part in the competitions.
Keeping those teams going through a COVID-19 lockdown has not been easy. But video training and social media has helped.
It's been a tough time for everyone, but talking to them on a regular basis through social media, it's quite clear that there is an embryonic community there within the footy clubs and various teams, and even just weekly training, getting them to get around each other and embrace that social aspect of community and also help embrace the calamity that's all around them. I'd really like to pay testament to their resilience and the fact that they're all sort of future focused, even though they haven't been able to play for a number of months now. They've all got one eye on the prize and they're all very keen to show me what they can do on the field, so I can't wait.
Taking cricket in Vanuatu as their inspiration, AFL Vanuatu's strategy extends well beyond getting good teams onto the field. And the hope is that the game can contribute to the reduction of non-communicable disease rates in key population groups. And the reduction of domestic violence is also a target.
We're committed to helping spread the message of reducing and hopefully eliminating gender-based violence through fostering some relationships with men and women, boys and girls who are playing footy all on the same field. And the other thing is just building some really strong community leadership through sports, because there's a lot of young people in Vanuatu who aspire to bigger and better things. And a lot of their heroes and their role models are international stars of sport. And we think that we can get some really great outcomes if we do the same thing on a more localized and smaller scale level of getting those young people to see themselves as the role models of the future for their community.
We would like to develop and get the game of footy big here in Vanuatu. I just pop into my email and there's good news coming out from the Ministry of Youth and Sport that all sports are resumed. So we're looking forward to get back on field.
AFL Vanuatu would love to be part of the next International Cup, which is now scheduled to take place in Melbourne next year, a year later than planned. Jared Landells knows they are coming from a long way back, compared to the current champions Papua New Guinea, Nauru and Fiji. But he says the year's delay is a year up Vanuatu's sleeve, as it gives them more time to catch up.
We had some preliminary discussions within AFL Vanuatu and our partners about either 2023 or 2026 being a soft target for reaching the International Cup. And look, who knows? We have some very good players in the men's and women's senior teams. Some of them have played in Australia before, so they've got some good experience with tactical knowledge and training techniques. And I'd be lying if I said that I wouldn't want to strive for the next International Cup, but it's a very competitive field and not everyone gets the chance to make it, so we'll try our best.
Talia Olatia reporting there. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Jordan Fennell. Thank you so much for listening, and join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.